the Constitution to allow marriages only between a man and a woman. 26 other states have similar bans in place. For NPR News, I'm Rory Gallagher in San Francisco.
Oil prices are falling slightly today. They're around $127 per barrel. These are down from a high set on May 22nd when they reached $135 per barrel. Oil prices could also be affected by the Atlantic hurricane season that began on Sunday. Tropical storm Arthur has already dwindled to a depression near Mexico, but two oil platforms near Mexico are still closed. Oil exports to the United States have been cut. Oil production was severely reduced during Hurricane Katrina. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Tires Plus Total Car Care, located at Prospect and Market View in Champaign. Tires Plus provides complete car repair and maintenance. More information is available at 366-3201. Support for today's broadcast comes from Provena Covenant Medical Center in Urbana, rated a top 5% hospital by Health Grades. More information available at provena.org. The staff and physicians of Provena encourage you to join them in supporting WILL.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different shows for you every week. If you'd like to find out about what we're doing for the rest of the week or catch up on programs you may have missed or sign up for our podcast, just go to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. Also want you to know that we're keeping track of some severe thunderstorms here this morning moving through our listening area, so we may indeed be interrupting our conversation just very briefly to bring you updates. We do have a line of severe storms that extends from McLean County down through DeWitt into Macon and Christian counties, and in fact, there is a severe thunderstorm warning that's in effect for Shelby, Moultrie, Christian, Macon, and southern Piatt counties, and that will be in effect until 11:30. There's also a severe thunderstorm warning for northeastern DeWitt, northern Piatt, and McLean counties until 11:45. And for a good part of our listening area, there is a tornado watch that has now been extended until 2 o'clock this afternoon, and that includes Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion counties, and that will be in effect until 2 o'clock this afternoon. So a good possibility of severe storms. You know, it's possible that severe thunderstorms can produce tornadoes, so you'll want to just keep aware of what's going on with the weather. And, of course, here on AM 580, we will do our best to keep you informed and bring you the latest weather information just as soon as we have it. On to our conversation here for this second hour of Focus 580. The early years of the 21st century have been marked by increasing conflict between secular and religious forces. And the question, one of the big questions we'll try to take on this morning, is can this battle be resolved peacefully? Our guest, sociologist Mark Juergensmeyer, says that if this struggle is largely about religion, it will never disappear. But in most cases, he says, religious ideas only come into play when people feel frustrated and desperate. And at that point, what was once a worldly struggle can take on the aura of sacred conflict. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will talk with Mark Juergensmeyer about his recent book. The title is Global Rebellion: Religious Challenges to the Secular State, From Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda. That's the subtitle of the book. It is published by the University of California Press. You can certainly find it, I'm sure, in the library or the bookstore. Mark Juergensmeyer is professor of sociology, and he is also director of global and international studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's the author of some other books, including he's the editor of Global Religions, An Introduction, also the author of The New Cold War, Religious Nationalism Confronts the Secular State, and also Gandhi's Way, A Handbook of Conflict resolution, both those books published by the University of California Press. Oh, and one more that I should mention, because we, in fact, talked about the book here on the show. That book is Terror in the Mind of God, and that's also published by the University of California Press. Well, questions and comments are welcome again as we move through this hour. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask callers is that people just try to keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep our program moving along. Professor Juergensmeyer, hello.
Good to be here.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I guess perhaps the place to start is with the basic idea here of the struggle, the very struggle that we're talking about here, the struggle between secular nationalism and some kind of alternative that has a kind of religious activism at its base. Let's start there. What is the problem, or as some people have seen it, what is the problem with secular nationalism?
Well, that's the question. For 20 years, I've been working at this, and this is a culmination of a lot of projects that I've been working on, interviews I've conducted around the world. My main question at the outset was, what's going on? Why is this violence happening? And what does religion have to do with it? And to find the answers, I went out and talked with people. I went out and talked with people who were supporters of movements, who were leaders of movements. I talked with Sheikh Yassin and Dr. Rantisi of Hamas. I went to prison to talk with people who were convicted of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center to try to get inside the Al-Qaeda mine. I talked with supporters of the Christian militia in the United States, radical Hindus and Sikhs in India, members of the Amish and Rikyo in Japan. And what impressed me was in all these different religious traditions in different parts of the world, acts of violence against the secular state are emerging at this particular moment of history. It seemed to me that couldn't possibly be coincidental. And the one thread that wove through all of these different cases was the conviction that the secular state, the promise of the nation state that emerged for most of the countries, you know, in the middle of the last century for us in the West earlier, the promise of the secular nation state is providing community, identity, authority, accountability, a just political structure, all those things that we would like to take for granted, somehow they felt didn't work. There was something fundamentally flawed in some cases. They didn't have their own nation as other people, other communities did. And in other cases, they felt that the secular state was manipulated or was controlled. In an era of globalization, it's easy to see why people would feel that way. So the common thread that united all of these cases, it seems to me, was a sense of discomfort about the idea of the secular nation state.
Mm. You said that initially there were perhaps three big questions that you asked yourself: what was going on, why it was that there was violence connected with this struggle, and what's religion got to do with it.
Right.
And just to pick up on the third one, and I think that probably there are people who think that this is about religion. Certainly, there has been a lot written about militant Islam and competing worldviews that are rooted in religion. And it's so because religious values and different kinds of sets of values, and we're talking about different people here, are important. That makes it easier for people to say, well, this really is all about religion. Is it all about religion?
Yeah, well, that would be an easy conclusion to make if this was simply an Islamic problem. If there was not, for example, Christian activism in the United States, or Hindus and Sikh activists in India, or Buddhist out on the streets in Sri Lanka, as they were just a couple, Buddhism of all religious traditions, just a couple weeks ago in Colombo, yeah. Buddhist monks were out breaking up a peace rally with sticks, saying, if you want peace, go back up to the northern part of Sri Lanka. They were fiercely opposed, in some cases involved in the militancy against the secular state in Sri Lanka.
That really surprises me. I would think that of all faiths, Buddhists would be the least likely to be involved in violence. But it seems
so
like it's something that cuts
so
across all different faiths and societies.
There are Jewish activists and terrorists. The Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister of Israel, wasn't killed by a Muslim. He was killed by a Jewish violent activist who felt that the peace accords that Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat were undertaking under the watchful eye of Bill Clinton. We all remember that moment when they shook hands in the Rose Garden. And it wasn't a matter of weeks afterwards when a Jewish activist used violence in order to try to destroy what he thought was the sellout of the State of Israel. And he thought he was commissioned by rabbis. He thought he had rabbinical authority in order to carry out his commands. So clearly another case in which religion provides the kind of moral framework and a way of thinking about a struggle that is essentially in its heart political, in some cases economic and social.
The fact that at this point that there are different people in different countries of different faiths that all seem to be involved in similar kinds of struggles would make one posit that there is some sort of much larger movement here going on. Maybe not necessarily that all of these things are linked, but is it in fact that they are linked, not in the sense that they get together periodically and have meetings and talk about strategy, but in the sense that it is part, it is a kind of a globalized a movement or a globalized kind of thought.
Or a globalized phenomenon.
Oh, yes, that's a better word, globalized phenomenon.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the kind of conclusion towards which I was struggling. Because of all these different cases are sheerly coincidence, that itself is remarkable. That, you know, at this particular moment in history throughout the planet, similar kinds of political religious activities are all happening at the same time. I think it makes a lot more sense to say, well, there must be a common thread. There must be something that everybody's experienced. Well, what is everybody experiencing at this particular moment of history? Globalization, the weakening of the structures of the nation state, the old confidence that there was a community of people that was culturally, religiously, linguistically identified that could have its own state. That was the whole idea of the Enlightenment concept. The idea of nationalism made sense only if you had a nation, if you had a single body of people who could express the will of their political will through a state. That seems like such a sensible idea, but we don't live in that kind of world. We live in a world where everybody can live everywhere, where culture is immediate and instant and goes throughout the planet, where you no longer have that kind of security of identity. And if we feel that, and I think all of us, and I mean Americans, people who would be listening to this program, feel that kind of, anomie of being facing one fast food franchise outlet after the other. Occasionally I drive across the country, and it's so startling to get off the freeway and find, all these signs and all these shops that look exactly like the ones I just saw at the last freeway outlet. Mm-hmm. So if we feel that kind of mind-numbing homogeneity of culture, just think how other people in other parts of the world feel. In the Middle East, we're worried about Al Jazeera TV, but the most popular program recently is not an Al Jazeera TV program. It's Friends. It's reruns of an old U.S. sitcom that's wildly popular in the Middle East. Well, there's nothing, I guess, wrong with that, but if you're the leader of a traditional religious movement and you look around and you see this is what people are watching and this is how people are kind of shaping their values and their perception of the world, you got to be a little bit nervous. Hmm.
Well, do you, it strikes me that sometimes in conversations that we have about the problem of failed or failing states, and I'm sure that I have asked questions like this myself and people I have talked with, one reaches for this idea that, well, if these people in these failed or failing states could find some common basis to organize themselves around. And I guess the thing that I find myself thinking about or reaching for is indeed the idea of a nation or nationalism, that is some kind of identity that rises above other kinds of identities, that would help. But it now I wonder in listening to you whether in fact that kind of hope is just in so many places is just futile. That's just not going futile is not going to happen.
Yeah, it's not totally futile. After the invasion of Iraq, I was there with a colleague from London School of Economics in a project looking at the reconciliation of societies in a crisis area. And what we tried to do was convene a group of people, representatives of different groups within factions within Iraqi society, Shia, Sunni, mullahs from Fallujah, secularists, and brought them together for kind of an encounter session, which went so well. We had a series of them. And then in more recent years, when it was difficult for us to go back to Baghdad, we met in Amman, Jordan, and Cairo, and continued this conversation. And I was surprised the degree to which, even in Iraq, and I say even in Iraq, because this is a newly created country, it was just lines in the sand after the end of the Ottoman Empire, there is a kind of Iraqi nationalism. And yet, of course, there are all these other tugs and pulls at identity, which are made even sharper by the political situation in Iraq. Of course, that's the paradox, because the internal politics of the country now is shaped by something that never used to be a problem, and that is ethnic and religious divisions. It's amazing how new these kind of confrontations are. We imagine, oh, there have been these old animosities against the Shia and Sunni that in this part of the world have gone back for centuries. Not really. Not in the way that they're now expressed. This is a very new kind of political situation that emerges when you have a state that now no longer has a vacuum at the center. And there's a power vacuum, and there's now people organizing and trying to find whatever means they can to organize in order to fill that vacuum. So it's a nationalism is not dead, but it is challenged by these forces that are often new communal forces, and it's also challenged by forces that are from outside and transnational identities and currents and moods.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mark Juergensmeyer. He is a professor of sociology and also director of global and international studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara, author of the book Terror in the Mind of God, and in a new one, Global Rebellion. The subtitle is Religious Challenges to the Secular State from Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda, and it is published by the University of California Press. I'd just like to again mention real quick that we do have some severe weather moving through our listening area this morning, and looking at the radar now, it looks like we got some pretty heavy storms going in parts of McLean and DeWitt, Piatt, Macon, a little bit of northern Shelby, and a good piece of Christian County. And there is, in fact, a severe thunderstorm warning that will be in effect for northern Shelby, Moultrie, Christian, Macon, and southern Piatt until 11:30, so about another 7-8 minutes. And then a severe thunderstorm warning for northeastern DeWitt, northern Piatt, and McLean counties until 11:45. And also a lot of our listening area is in a tornado watch that now will be in effect until 2 o'clock this afternoon. And that includes Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby, and Vermilion counties. So do keep aware of the weather. It's moving pretty rapidly, and we do have the possibility of severe thunderstorms, and that can mean tornadoes. So we'll try to keep you informed of what's going on, and if it comes near you, you want to seek shelter and you want to keep yourself safe. Questions are certainly welcome this morning, as always, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. We do have someone here to bring into the conversation, someone listening in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. What I missed in the discussion so far, and you may in fact treat this in your written work on the subject, is the extent to which this promotion of religious objection to nationalism has, in the last really two generations, been promoted particularly by the United States as a foreign policy tool. I mean, notably in the Middle East, but not exclusively, this real enemy in the Middle East, who America's control of Middle East energy from the Eisenhower administration, was seen to be Arab nationalism with Nasser as the center of it. The destruction of secular nationalism in the Middle East was followed by the U.S. promoting religious alternatives to this, to the point of finally contributing to the establishment of Hamas. I mean, the U.S. and Israel worked to establish a religious alternative to the secular PLO. This is a pattern, I mean, a policy of the American government that was repeated around the world from Vietnam to Latin America, where the way to build an opposition to a secular nationalism that the U.S. didn't like was to build up a religious group that would be opposed to it.
No, it's an interesting observation, and it's true that there is a certain amount of blowback to American policies earlier on, some of which did in fact promote religious movements. The CNN has this wonderful series on the Cold War, where they in the Afghan section of that series, there's a some footage of Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yes, that's important.
During the Mujahideen's fight against the Soviets. Standing on a truck saying, fight on right. for Allah.
Oh, yeah, and that's the Carter administration in the late 70s.
Right.
And it wasn't new policy with them. I mean, you know, Brzezinski said, yeah, you know, what's more important here, attacking the Soviet Union or a few stirred-up Muslims? Well, a few stirred-up Muslims ended in 9/11. But
that's right, because at that time it was the godless commies that we were worried about.
That's right. What he was doing was finding the most fanatical murderers that he could in the Middle East, religious-based groups, and sending them into Afghanistan to harry the Soviets. And this was even before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So, I mean, the reason Brzezinski was doing that, I mean, and he, after all, was a liberal, you know, was that this was not a new policy by the U.S.
Yes, and it's not just the U.S. The Indira Gandhi was alleged to have been involved in helping to promote the Khalistan movement in the Punjab of Sikhs against the more secular opponents. She was hoping it would undercut the secular Akali Party, which was the Congress Party, her own party's greatest rival in the Punjab. And, of course, that turned out to be a huge movement. The Khalistan movement for 10 years, the Punjab in northern India was in the grips of an internal conflict that in 1984 led to Mrs. Gandhi's own death as assassination by in the hands of Sikhs after she had ordered the invasion of the Golden Temple to try to kill Bindranwal and his crowd. So it's been a common ploy of secular leaders to try to use religious politics in a manipulative way against their own opponents, and of course, as you said, in some cases has come back in blowback to haunt them.
I have some more weather information. I must jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has now issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Coles County, northern Moultrie County, Douglas County, eastern Piatt, and southern Champaign, and this will be in effect until 12:15 this afternoon. These locations are impacted: Savoy, Arthur, Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Tolono, Philo, Posotum, Cook's Mill. Do keep in mind that severe thunderstorms can have damaging winds. There can be lightning. There can be heavy rain. There can be hail. And, of course, sometimes severe thunderstorms do indeed produce tornadoes. So you want to keep aware of the weather, report any severe weather or damage to your local emergency manager. And, of course, stay tuned here to AM 580. We'll bring you all the latest weather information. Once again, this is a severe thunderstorm warning until 12:15 Central Time this afternoon. This includes northern Coles County, northern Moultrie, Douglas County, eastern Piatt, and southern Champaign. And these storms have been moving across our listening area here this morning, and we expect that they'll continue to sweep right through. So it won't probably be all that long before they'll be right on top of us here in Champaign-Urbana, and then no doubt will affect Danville and parts east. So as that continues to happen, we will certainly keep you aware, and do also keep in mind that for about another 10 minutes now until 11:45, we do have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for northeastern DeWitt, northern Piatt, and McLean counties. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mark Juergensmeyer. He's professor of sociology, director of global and international studies at University of California, Santa Barbara, and is author of the book Global Rebellion. The subtitle is Religious Challenges to the Secular State, From Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda.
We do, and I also grew up in central Illinois, so I know those storms very well. It brings me back to my childhood, watching those enormous clouds boil up out of the cornfields and terrorize the Midwest.
Well, and they can move pretty fast and cause a lot of damage. So it's always been, we've always thought it was really important for people to know about these things. So that's why we have put a lot of effort into bringing people weather information. So I'm glad you appreciate the fact that.
Well, my sister and my brother-in-law live in Urbana, and they're probably listening to this program, and I wish them well, and tell them to take cover in case the storm heads their way.
All right, very good. Well, we have another caller here in Urbana. Let's talk with him. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your Illinois roots, whether you were the Juergensmeyer that I knew back in the 60s.
Probably was.
Yeah, I think so. Do you have an Illinois degree?
Yep, and went to U of I, proud U of I alumna.
Yeah, well, good. I thought maybe it was the same one. I was a campus minister at the time. Uh-huh. I have a question. Obviously, it seems to me the passion that many have for planting democracy in different parts of the world, passionate conviction that the democratic way is the best way to build nation states. This must be, I think, very much questioned, and I guess I'd just be interested in your comments about either the prospects for or the futility of nation building in this way. And I'll get off the air to listen to your response.
Okay, great. And, of course, it depends on what you mean by democracy. I was particularly interested in this question, what kind of alternative these religious activists preferred. And every single one of them used the word democracy in a positive sense. They said they were for democracy, that Islam, for example, promotes democracy. The leaders of Hamas told me that they were a democratic movement both within and outside in politics, and they believed that democracy was the right way, and they believed that it had been religiously ordained. Now, what did they mean by democracy? In some cases, they simply meant, you know, rule by the majority. That is, if it's most people in Egypt are Muslims, for example, then Egypt should be a Muslim state. That's a pretty simple idea of democracy, and one, of course, that doesn't involve all the protections and civil liberties and idea of tolerance that most of us have. But there are also more sophisticated versions of that same idea, also supported by religious activists. I mean, the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, for example, is a model of constitutional protection of human rights. They have protection of rights for women. They have protection of rights for the press. They have freedom not only of speech but also of employment, of food. It's just a remarkable document. Now, of course, on the other hand, they have the idea of the just ruler, the Ayatollah, who can then interpret the will of Islam in a political sense and decide which of the rules that are promulgated are according to the principles of Islam and which are not. You can say, well, that's the straw that broke the camel's back. That's the one thing that brings down the whole idea. And yet the idea is there. In other words, this modern notion of human rights, of democracy, even of toleration. In Egypt, I had religious activists who were trying to interpret Sharia in such a way that would be incumbent on Muslims, but not on Copts, on Egyptian Christians, those who were not a part of the religious tradition. They said, just as you have, you know, rules in your country that is for everybody, but you make certain exceptions for religious communities, who are somewhat different, or like Native Americans who have their own, you know, their own tradition, their own customs, that also there should be separate rules where cops are allowed to drink, for example. They would allow that. I mean, it's a very interesting. They themselves are struggling. The religious, they meaning religious activists who are often involved in a political program, are struggling with the same issues of pluralism and of trying to maintain, and on the one hand, a semblance of community, of political and religious community, cultural community, that can support an idea of nation-state or some transnational entity. At the same time, being open, being tolerant, recognizing the pluralism of commitments and faith, and ascribing to the principles of human rights. So the idea of democracy is more, the ideal of democracy is more universal than we may think. The way it is practiced, of course, can be quite varied.
It strikes me that the one reason that these conflicts can become so intractable is if, when we get to the point where each side seems to see the other as the personification of evil, and that doesn't give you much room for negotiation if you think that the other side is playing on the team of Satan.
That's right, and of course we can do the same thing. We can say that, you know, we're battling the evildoers, and everyone who disagrees with us are evil and are satanic, and religious activists have done the same thing with the West. We've been Satanized and characterized as being a part of an evil empire. Yet it's interesting, all of the activists with whom I spoke made personal exceptions. You know, they would tell me, for example, and the Hamas activists, you know, we regard America as evil in the way in which it supported what they regarded as a kind of dictatorial Israeli rule over the Palestinian territories. And yet, I said kind of nervously, does this mean that any Americans would be, you know, fair game? And he looked at me and sort of startled, and he said, oh, not you, you're our guest, you know, as if he was offended that I would even think of such a thing. This is Dr. Rantisi, the political head of the Hamas movement with whom I was speaking. That I would even think of such a thing, that on a personal level, persons are persons, and they don't attribute to political policies or political programs to the individuals within those countries.
We have about, say, 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I'd just like to quickly introduce our guest, Mark Juergensmeyer. He's professor of sociology, director of global and international studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and he's the author of the recent book Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State from Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda, and the book is published by the University of California Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, is it possible, if really what we're talking about here is a political struggle, and the argument is over political issues, can you strip away some of the religious rhetoric that maybe gets in the way to get down to more of a conversation that really is about politics?
Yes, I think so, and I think that's a good way of putting it. It may actually work the other way around. That is, as political solutions are found, religious rhetoric will kind of fall away. Because I think that often conflicts, social conflicts, and cultural, a sense of cultural loss of identity, these things become religionized out of frustration. They get religionized when people see no other way out, no other way of thinking about a solution to a problem other than in these kind of grand terms of cosmic war, the great confrontation of good and evil, of right and wrong, and religion and irreligion. So if you can locate your struggle in this grander scheme, then, you know, it gives you hope where otherwise there wouldn't be hope. I remember talking with Dr. Rantisi again of the Hamas movement and pointing out that, you know, the Israeli army is really pretty formidable, that even suicide bombings, and of course he wouldn't use that term, he called it self-martyrdom, but even these kinds of attacks, as you know, terrible as they are and how disturbing as they are for the Israelis, are not going to change their policies and are not going to change their military strength. and you simply can't win using those measures. And he looked at me as if he was speaking to a small child, and he said, well, he said, maybe not in my lifetime, and maybe not in my children's lifetime, and maybe not in my children's children's lifetime, but in my children's 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 lifetime, we might prevail. He said, because this is God's war, not our war, and we cannot lose. Well, if that's the frame of reference in which you see your struggle, then it gives hope in a hopeless situation, and that a temporary setback is simply a skirmish in a much larger war. So it is easy to see how political frustration could lead to a different way, a more religious way of framing a problem, and that with some of these political solutions, then the extreme religious framing kind of falls away. We've seen exactly this happen in Northern Ireland, where even Ian Paisley, the old firebrand, you know, supporter of the Unionist Party, who would never accept peace with the IRA, with those Catholics, and he regarded the Nobel Prize that was given to those who were trying to frame the Good Friday peace process in Northern Ireland as a bit of a farce. It was just a couple weeks ago that Ian Paisley himself finally accepted the idea of the peace process and agreed to be a part of it. I mean, isn't that amazing? Where, you know, this old kind of rigid, hardline approach and the kind of satanization of a conflict eventually as a real solution emerges, it just simply kind of dissipates and falls away.
Well, just I wonder, though, if you take that in as an example, whether it also doesn't suggest that outside influence, people who are interested in trying to provide some kind of structure and assistance in moderating a conflict is not going to do any good until the parties to the conflict decide that they want to pursue some alternative other than violence. And until they make that commitment, it doesn't matter what anybody from the outside does.
Yeah, I think that's right. At least some of them. I mean, if you look at the Good Friday situation, it was just a handful of people on both sides who decided we've got to start doing something to get out of this situation. And the hardliners on both sides really resisted it, and they often resisted it violently. I mean, one of the most severe attacks from the IRA side at Omagh actually happened after the first Good Friday Accords, when they were trying to scuttle the peace process through an act of violence that they hope would make everybody unite around them. But that by that time, the mindset was such that nobody overreacted, and nobody said, oh, well, you know, suddenly the IRA becoming violent again, we have to attack all of them. They took it for what it was, just an extreme act of a small faction, basically ignored this fact, tried to find the culprits and bring them to justice, of course, but not regard it as something characteristic of the whole IRA community. And it did not scuttle the peace process, but that means that you had to have political leaders who would not just take a knee-jerk, tit-for-tat, violence-for-violence approach whenever they saw some extremist trying to alienate, marginalize the movement and keep peace from happening.
Do you think it's the case, I think that some people might suspect that with some of the groups that we talked about, that their turn to violence was, in a sense, not a last resort, it was almost a first resort. Would it be, in fact, the case if you looked at least at some of these places where you would see that some of these political groups did try other means, and that it was not a case that the first thing that they thought was to take up arms?
Well, in the Palestinian case, of course, it was largely a secular movement until around 1989, 1990, the first intifada. And that's when Hamas came on the scene, and there was a kind of Islamicization of the struggle. But that's also true to some extent on the Israeli side, that the whole idea of a kind of kind of messianic Zionism didn't emerge in Israel until well after the 67 war And later on, when it appeared possible with the settlements on the West Bank that there would be a wider Israel. So both on the Jewish side and on the Muslim side of a conflict that originally was over purely over land and over territory and had hopes of a political accommodation, there were these more strident religious voices.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We'll continue talking with our guest, Mark Juergensmeyer. I'd like to remind you that we do have some severe weather in our listening area this morning, and there is, in fact, a severe thunderstorm warning that is in effect and will be for about another 30 minutes for northern Coles County, northern Moultrie County, Douglas County, eastern Piatt County, and southern Champaign County. And indeed, some of these places are affected: Savoy, Arthur, Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Tolono, Philo, Posotum, Cook's Mill. That's in effect until 12:15 this afternoon. Some severe thunderstorms moving pretty quickly here through our area, and we expect that to continue to be the case here for the rest of this morning and also some this afternoon. Our staff of meteorologists and weather forecasters are tracking the storms, and they're keeping us on top of it, and we're doing our best to do the same for you. So do keep aware of the weather, the possibility that there could be severe thunderstorms, and in fact a large part of our listening area is included in a tornado watch that will be in effect until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Our guest, Mark Juergensmeyer, he is a professor of sociology, also director of global and international studies at University of California, Santa Barbara, and is author of the book Global Rebellion: Religious Challenges to the Secular State, From Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda, and it's published by the University of California Press. What do you think, where do you think we are headed with this, what now seems to have become a kind of a globalized or a global conflict between those people who continue to argue that the secular state can and should be the kind of way that we organize things, and those people in these various kinds of religious activist groups, sometimes militant groups, who say that the secular state has failed, it doesn't represent our values, we want our interests acknowledged and protected, and if it takes armed rebellion, well, so be it. I mean, where are we going with this?
Well, I don't think religious activism is with us forever. We've talked about two kinds of problems, and one is fairly local political and social tensions that become religionized, and then there's this larger kind of issue of the failure of confidence in the nation state that's related to globalization. The first kinds of problems, in a sense, are more easily solved. You can say, well, golly, is Israel-Palestine situation, is that easily solved? It is, in a sense, that you can visualize the problem and you can imagine solutions in a way that, that although difficult, could work. The larger historical problem of this moment of globalization is going to be resolved in a different way, and that's through a different kind of world, a world that in which the nation state maybe doesn't disappear but finds its location within a larger pattern or other patterns of association and political identity. For example, the emergence of the EU. I mean, the very part of the world that spawned the nation state now has spawned regional identities where countries like France and Germany no longer use their old currency. Could you imagine France without the franc, you know, Germany without the Deutschmark? And now we're in a whole different era of identity and relationships in Europe. That has a transnational element to it. Is that part of the future? the increasing emergence of global agencies of accountability and authority, like the ones that are concerned with climate change or the International Criminal Court, will these become increasingly a part of our attempts globally to deal with problems on a global basis? And will they give us a greater sense of kind of global security where we no longer are quite as concerned about the fact the nation state doesn't have the same authority and accountability structures that it used to? You see, what I'm talking about is the transitions of history. We're in a moment of change. The nation state has only been around a short blip of time in terms of recorded history. and for Europe and America, you know, for a couple hundred years, and for the rest of the world, much, much less. So there's no reason to think it's going to stay forever. There'll be other kinds of associations and political organizations that emerge, and as they do, the sense of discomfort about this old creaky vessel of the nation-state is going to change, and people will change with it. So time will tell, but my best prognosis is that 10 or 15 years from now, we'll be living with quite a different set of problems than the one we're living with right now.
Yeah. Well, we have maybe about 5-6 minutes left. Another warning I want to pass on to folks here. The Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning, this one for Cumberland County in east central Illinois and also southeastern Shelby County in central Illinois. That will be in effect until 12:30. At 11:47, the National Weather Service meteorologist detected a severe thunderstorm capable of producing penny-sized hail and damaging winds in excess of 60 miles an hour. It was located 13 miles west of Neoga, or about 7 miles east of Shelbyville, and was moving to the southeast at 55 miles an hour, so pretty good clip there. These locations are impacted: Neoga, Toledo, Jewett, and Greenup. So this is, again, a severe thunderstorm warning for Cumberland County and southeastern Shelby County. That in effect until 12:30. So do keep in mind that severe thunderstorms can produce tornadoes, and of course you can have high winds, you can have hail, you can have dangerous lightning, and you just want to keep on top of what's going on with the weather. And again, we will do our best to bring you the weather information as it becomes available to us. I'm interested just in extending what you were talking about there, about in perhaps speculating about what the future of the idea of the nation state is, and whether you think that we might see more kinds of flexible arrangements, more kinds of, confederations and arrangements like that, where you do maybe have larger groups, groups that are associated but are also semi-autonomous. I know that that's not easy to work something like that out, but whether you could imagine something like that happening. So indeed, it makes something of a compromise between the idea of the nation state and the demands of the significant distinct groups of people to, in a sense, have autonomy, govern themselves, have an ability to create their own identity, maybe within some kind of larger structure.
Sure, well, that's already happened at the EU and NAFTA and CAFTA. In North and Latin America are kind of moving that direction. China and the kind of relationship it has with Hong Kong and the same kind of relationship I think it would hope to have with Taiwan. Now with a new government in Taiwan, no longer is Taiwan pressing for independence, and the possibility of some sort of reconciliation with China would lead to the same kind of separate nations and yet within the same polity within East Asia. So yes, I think that there will be these kind of emerging associations in different parts of the world, and there will also be different forms of world governance. I don't think there'll be a world government right away, but one could easily imagine structures of accountability, and particularly on environmental issues and the things that, as there already is. I mean, in some ways, the WTO does now play a transnational economic role. It's the reason why the protests are against what are regarded as the excesses of exploitation of international economic system are aimed at the WTO, and rightfully so. You know, they were astonished in Seattle when this first happened because they said, we're just a trade organization. We're just trying to facilitate the world economic system. And the protesters said, exactly, that's what we're against, and you're it. So we're already moving in that direction, and there's no reason not to expect more of it.
All right, let's talk with at least one more caller here in the time that remains. Champaign County is the caller, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to go in a different direction with the very information you just put up, because I think your hypothesis is off track. I think let's start with China. China is actually asserting more of the Chinese nation-state, if you call it that, and taking over control of Hong Kong under the conditions it did was an assertion of nation-state. You see it in the nature of the Chinese government and in the nature of how it works in the society. So it's actually spreading. It had to use certain conditions to get Hong Kong. And the same issue with Taiwan, the same issue with the ongoing conflict with Tibet, and even this morning, somewhere on the radio I heard that someone was at actually it was on this program, the earlier program, where China talked about slowly but surely eventually dominating the world. And the Chinese state is not recent. It's 2,000 years old in various forms. One more thing, and then I'll let you respond. In Europe, you've got the constant reaction to the bureaucracy of the European Union and so many states, whether it's in England, in Britain, in Netherlands, in France, resisting the imposition of authority and by European Union bureaucrats and European Union uber state, if you want to call it that. So I think the evidence is the other direction, that ethnicity, ethnic groups, and other organizations, including the nation state, are reasserting themselves against the attempted dominance by world entities such as the UN, World Trade Organization, etc.
And I can give you about a minute and a half, Professor Juergensmeyer, to respond to what is a good and a complex question.
Yeah, no, I think the caller is right. Both things are happening, and I think it's more complicated, of course, than we've been talking about it, because there have been different kinds of nation states, and the United States as a national entity has embraced a plurality of peoples and even countries, I mean, absorbing, for example, the sovereign country of Hawaii into its statehood in a way that's different in general from the way in which the European states have worked, although, of course, Portugal had a relationship with Brazil. It's been a complex history of where the nation state and relationship with other entities, and yet it seems to me that this particular moment of history is moving a slightly different direction, where this tension is seen in relationship to regional and transnational organizations, and transnational even beyond the UN, because the UN, of course, is a federation, are a representative body of nation states, and now there are all these transnational entities outside of the UN. So we're living in a much more complex world in which global and transnational entities are increasingly playing a vital role. And why, getting back to the subject of my book, one of the most interesting movements of religious activism within this century, Al-Qaeda or the jihadi groups related to it, are transnational, that they are, in a sense, an alternative globalization. They're challenging the whole global power of the United States, right, at its basis, and what they imagine to be an American-driven globalization. So we live in a world not only with competing interests of nation states, but competing globalizations, and that's what makes this world so interesting and so difficult and so vexing and disturbing.
And there we must stop, because we are at the end of the time. Our guest is Mark Juergensmeyer. He's professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. If you'd like to read more on the subject, look for his book, Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State from Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda. It's published by the University of California Press. And Professor Juergensmeyer, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Support for the broadcast today is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign, for over 15 years providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned. Coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Much more throughout the afternoon, and we'll do our best to continue to stay on top of the weather situation here. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
So this afternoon during the noon hour to bring us up to date on the weather. And, of course, along the way, if anything happens to pop up in the meantime, we'll get that to you right away. In the 1 o'clock hour today of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with gardener and food writer Jeannie Kelly. We'll talk with her about her book Blue Eggs and Yellow Tomatoes. We'll celebrate the summer growing and cooking season this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. July wheat, 812, down 9. September, 824 and a half, down 10 and a half. July wheat in Chicago, 773 and a half, down 9. September, 789 and a half, down 9 and a quarter. July corn, 616, up 1 quarter. September, 629 and a half, up 1 half. December, 644 and a quarter, up 1. March, 658 and a half, up 1 and a quarter. July beans, 1375 and a half, up 10. August, 1384, up 13 and a quarter. September, 1371, up 10. November, 1369 and a half, up 11. July meal, 347.50, up 450. July oil, 61.87.